Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 26 of The Law Entrepreneur. My name is Neil Tyra. I'm your host, as always. And today, we have a really special guest, one that I'm just enormously thrilled to be able to share with you as we speak with David Sparks, otherwise known as McSparky. Now, David is largely responsible, he and his co-host, Katie Floyd, for starting me down this rabbit hole called podcasting. David and Katie are the hosts of a very, very popular podcast called The Mac Power Users. And it was the first podcast that I ever listened to, and I listen to it to this day. And largely as a result of my infatuation with their podcast, I started thinking about doing a podcast of my own. And I can only hope at some point in my life to be as successful as they are. But in any case, David, aside from being a podcaster, he's also a blogger. As I mentioned, he has the nickname or the nom de plume of McSparky, and he writes on all things Macintosh and Apple related on his blog. He also, as a writer, has written several books, notably his field guides, which are just that, guides on how to use specific Apple applications in the field, as well as being a videographer. He makes a lot of videos, both for his ebooks and field guides, as well as on behalf of products that he endorses and uses on a regular basis, such as OmniFocus and others. So Dave is just a really talented guy in terms of technology, and is just known throughout as being one of the brightest guys in terms of Apple related products. But his day job is he's an attorney out on the West Coast, out in California, and recently transitioned from being in a firm to his own solo practice. So it's really interesting to hear, with his background as a technology expert, how that transition from middle size or large law firm to a solo practice has gone for him in comparison to some of our other guests. So I'm thrilled to be able to bring to you on episode 26 here, David Sparks. Hey there, David. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me, Neil. It's my pleasure.
I appreciate you taking the time to be with me today. As most of my listeners already know, David has a couple of alter egos here that dominate his time, and I have the weakness of being a David Sparks and a McSparky a fanboy. So I've been
nothing weak about that.
I've been following you for a long, long time, and in fact, as I told you before, you're largely responsible for this whole podcast endeavor of mine, because my very first podcast that I started listening to was Mac Power Users, which is a podcast that David does with Katie Floyd that focuses on all things Apple. And so from that comes, by way of my infatuation, comes The Law Entrepreneur. What I'd like to focus a little bit more, though, today, rather than the McSparky persona, is your day job, as you like to refer to it, as an attorney. Now, I understand from listening to your podcast before that you were in big law or medium-sized law for a while, and that you've recently transitioned to a solo practice. So can you kind of give our listeners a little background on your role as an attorney and how you've come to be where you are today?
Sure. When I was in law school, I was externing in the federal district court, and I was a hotshot in law school, so I had a lot of great options. And I went to interview a lot of big firms, and they all kept, you know, every time I would go to the interview, this is back in the early 90s, they would, I'd say at the end of the interview, what do you expect of me? That was, you know, always my question at the end, and it was always some integer followed by the word hours, you know.
Right.
1,800 hours, 2,000 hours. And it just seemed to me like, I don't know, I just got through college and law school and I just did not want to jump on another treadmill. I just wanted to try cases. So I got with a small firm and I joined a small firm. They, you know, because they answered the question when I asked, what do you expect of me? They said, we expect you to win, which was, to me, the answer I guess I was looking for the whole time.
Kind of music to your ears at that point.
Yeah, exactly. So I tried my first case, I think about a month after I got sworn in. Opposing counsel called me up. He said, son, I looked up your bar number and you don't have one yet. And that was just, it was quite an experience. I didn't win the case, though, because it really motivated me. But the but so I did almost exclusive litigation for several years. And over the course of something like 20 years, I transitioned to where I'm much more of a transactional lawyer. In fact, now I'm doing almost, you have to drag me kicking and screaming into litigation at this point. Not to say that I'm not still not in a little bit of it, but I'm trying to get out of it. But
as I like to refer to it as, we're becoming reformed litigators.
Yeah, it just, I, you know, that's a whole nother conversation probably, but I really like what I do. I'm one of those weird lawyers that enjoys my job. I like helping people and I feel like I'm doing that. But you know, between me kind of being busy with the other stuff I was doing with Max Barkey and just coming to the realization that I'm just not a meeting person. I'm just not well suited for what I originally thought I was going to do when I started as a lawyer, you know, climb up through the firm and become a partner and all that stuff. And I don't like that. I'm too much of a control freak. I mean, a lot of this is personal failings. I'm not good at playing politics. I mean, all the stuff you need to succeed in that environment is just not my nature. And so I decided I wanted to do something different. And I went solo about a year and a half ago now. And it's been really great for me. There's so much to say about it, but my only regret is I didn't do it sooner.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that one of the things that motivated you to becoming a solo is something that you've known about yourself really from the time you graduated from law school. That is, you know who you are and you know how your personality fits in with what's needed to succeed in some of these other legal situations. And sounds like it wasn't a perfect fit for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, but you know, in fairness, the place I was at was a relatively small firm, and it wasn't really that much politics and stuff going on. But it still just wasn't my thing.
Right. So, how long did you plot your getaway into solo practitioner?
You know, I did not plot it that long. I think that I think it's one of those things that your subconscious mind decides before your conscious mind is aware of.
Yeah.
And I can tell you the impetus for it all, and maybe if this had not happened, I may still be there. I don't know. Is there was a litigation matter that kind of got ugly fast, and it got assigned to me at the point that it was starting to kind of go off the rails. And I spent like 4 months working that case up, and you know, we had a trial date got moved up on us, and there was just a ton of work to be done, and I threw myself at it really hard, and we got a good result. But in the aftermath of it all, I realized that, you know, my own clients, the people that I had, you know, that were loyal, you know, to me, that were people that I had retained, were getting ignored. Mm-hmm. My, you know, Max Barkey side of my life was getting ignored. And, you know, I just felt like I didn't want to have that loss of control again. And also, I think that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back on big litigation for me. And I said, that's enough. And I made the decision, and within a month, I was out of there.
Yeah, from the people that I've interviewed and have asked the same question to, I think they fall into two camps. There are those who actively plot their getaway and plan extensively for their transition. And then there's others like myself, and sounds like, you know, to a degree you as well, who jump first and look later, or just know that that's what they're going to do and just plunge right in.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any middle ground.
Yeah. And in fairness, I've been practicing now 23 years. So, I mean, I have a nice stable of clients. I knew I could probably get by if I think I knew it in my guts from the beginning. I've known it for years, and I make some money on the Max Sparky stuff I do too. I sell books, which helps. So I knew I didn't have to, make big, big bucks right on the solo practice, and I could still pay the mortgage. The interesting thing is my personality is one, my general clientele are people who don't like to get into lawsuits and who like to take their lawyer's advice and generally try to avoid big problems. I'm a very much of a proactive attorney, I guess I would say. And those are terrible clients for big law firms, because you need people that are angry and getting lots of lawsuits, to keep the machine running.
Sure.
And so when I left, they were really fine. They're like, okay, take your clients, but I don't know how you're going to pull it off, because these aren't people that are going to, be getting in big lawsuits. I don't know how you're going to, make it. And it's turned out, it's worked out just fine for me.
Well, that sounds great, but let's talk about what have been your biggest challenges then going solo. You bring a lot of, a big skill set to the table outside of the practice of the law that other potential solos might not have, or might not have as much an abundance as you do. So is there been a particular area that you found more challenging than you thought?
So many, honestly.
It wasn't an easy path paved with gold, huh?
Well, I would say it's generally been relatively easy. I mean, most of the I've had a few surprises, but I mean, it's hard.
Sure.
Going out and doing your own thing. One of the guys I spoke with, and I would recommend you have him on as a guest at some point, is Ernie Svensson over at Ernie the Attorney. And
oh, he's sure.
Faculty member at the ABA for a lot of things. And he gave me some great advice. He says, Dave, the two reason people most often fail when they go solo is, number one is they don't have a personality that can go attract clients. There's somebody that's been in the closet at the big firm for big years, and they just don't have whatever it is that you need to go get clients to believe and trust in you and hire you. And then the second reason to get into it is all the little nitpicky stuff drags them down. And because I'm a nerd and I do a lot of technology, I wasn't so worried about the nitpicky stuff. And frankly, I can get along with people. I think I could probably get clients. So that was reassuring to me. That being said, once I got started, it is tough. I think one of my problems is I'm too much of a control freak. Even when I was at the firm, I always wanted to be the person. I proofread everything anything that went on with my signature was largely me.
Sure.
I've never been good at handing off work to other people. And that puts a limit on the amount of work you can do. It doesn't scale. And I'm still struggling with that. I mean, just yesterday I hired my accountant to start doing all my monthly finance stuff. Because up until now, I've got the spreadsheets, the Quicken stuff. Sure. I've been doing that myself, which is completely insane. Because, I could be making money working for clients or writing books, but instead I'm spending like 3 hours a month processing all the finances for all this stuff.
Balancing your checkbook.
Yeah, what is wrong with me?
You're not alone in that regard. We had Pat Yevics on, who is lovingly referred to in the state of Maryland here as the mother of all solos. She works for the Maryland Bar Association. And she said the number one task for any new solo is to find a good accountant.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I have a good accountant, except I wasn't giving her the day-to-day operations. I was giving her the big stuff. And I was thinking, what am I thinking? This is crazy. So, little things like that, I'm starting to explore. Part of my problem was when I left, I took on some litigation with me as I left because I was worried about paying the rent. And the transactional clientele has grown to such an extent, and the amount of transactional work has grown to keep me busy enough that I'm really backing off of litigation. I just handed over a a lucrative litigation matter to an attorney friend of mine who says, Dave, you know, what's wrong with you? What, this is a good case. It's a good client. They pay the bills. I'm like, yeah, but in order for me to do this right, I'd need to bring on an associate. And, you know, I just have to go in a direction that I'm not willing to go right now.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm sure that attorney will refer me transactional work going forward and it'll probably all work out fine. But he's definitely getting the better end of that bargain.
Aside from adding your accountant to the everyday team, have you offloaded or outsourced any other work to, say, virtual assistants or real assistants?
One of the things I did from day one is I hired Ruby Receptionist as my phone service, and you've probably heard of them before.
They are my receptionist as well.
I think they do a great job. A couple solo friends have that I've referred them to have said, oh, that's crazy. Yeah, it's too expensive. And they're about $250 a month. And I said, you know, it's money well spent. It's my receptionist. And when someone calls, a human answers. And that's really great. There are several third-party virtual assistant services I've looked into. When I was doing some litigation after I first left, I hired a couple paralegals in off-hour work for me.
Sure.
I even have hired a virtual assistant to do things like organize documents for me on stuff that is not privileged on occasion. But as the practice has transitioned to, as it's kind of evolved, I've really become this transactional guy. And my clients are constantly sending me contracts to review and corporate stuff to work on. None of that stuff really lends itself to handing off to someone else. The clients definitely want my hand in the stuff. They don't want somebody else's. So I'm aiming more at the administrative side of things and where can I, you know, offload some of that.
Right.
But even that is really, there's not that much to it. I mean, I feel like we're kind of at the beginning of a revolution in the practice of law. And that's exciting for me. I mean, the old model of, you know, getting a big firm and charge a bunch of money per hour and the slower you are, the more money you make, that stuff needs to go away. And so I'm really enjoying this. Like a lot of the stuff I do is flat fee. I mean, someone says, I need you to write a distribution agreement for me. And I know the client well, and I know their business and I know what it's going to take. And I'll give them a number and say, it'll cost you X. And they say, great. And I don't write down how much time it takes me. When they're on the phone with me, they don't have to look at their watch and wonder how much it's costing them. And it's largely worked for me.
Yeah, I think with that transition, it's going hand in hand with the use of technology in the law office so that you're able to, able to provide services in a fixed fee manner. And the idea of billing on an hourly basis and all the attendant overhead that goes along with that kind of model, I think you're right, is going away. The model is changing.
I sure hope so. I mean, clients hate it. And most attorneys, I think that's one of the reasons why so many attorneys are miserable when you look at the surveys.
Yeah, the chasing the billable hour and all the other as we said, attendant circumstances go along with that kind of approach.
Yeah, I went and gave a talk at a rather large firm recently. They had asked me to come in and explain how to use the iPad. A bunch of lawyers had iPads and they wanted to get better at being a lawyer and using the iPad. So they said, you know, we do these lunchtime briefings. Would you be willing to come and do one for us? I said, sure. So I showed up. And I've given a lot of these talks. I gave a talk like this to the Federal Judicial College. I mean, I talk to lawyers sure. all the time, but I hadn't done one in a big firm for a while, and it was a completely different vibe. Yeah. You know, people showed up, they got their turkey sandwich, and they sat there, and I talked to them, and they were answering email while I was talking to them, and as soon as I was done, they bolted for the door. I mean, nobody stood around to ask any questions, or it was just really bizarre to me, and I was thinking, man, I must be getting terrible at these talks. I made a comment to the office manager. I said, man, I guess I'm sorry. I didn't do a good job. Nobody really even seemed like they cared. And he says, no, that's just the way it is. They want to get their billables in.
Right.
You know, it's like, I guess it was towards the end of the month or something. And I was just thinking,
areas that the practice of law is changing is largely as a result of technology is the office environment itself. And in fact, the real question of, do I need an office? So how did you address that question when you transitioned to solo practice?
I've got one of these shared office space things, you know, I pay $100 a month and it's a fancy address that my mail goes to. And when I need, they've got a really nice conference room. I do a lot of board of director meetings and, you know, shareholder meetings with some of my smaller corporations. And so when we need the fancy office, I have it available to me. When I first started, I could have also leased an office in that suite if I wanted. But, you know, I've been going to an office for 23 years. I mean, getting up, putting the tie on, doing that for 23 years. I've got a little bit of, I guess, post, you know, traumatic stress or something. I've got a really nice home office and I've got, you know, a backyard with a garden that I can sit in and work. And I decided, well, for the first 6 months, I'm going to try and just work from home and see how that goes. And granted, my kids are older, so it's not as hard as it would be for someone with like a 3-year-old. But it's just been fine. And a lot of my clients are business people in Orange and LA County. So about once every 2 or 3 weeks, I call it riding the circuit. I get in my car and I drive around and meet a bunch of clients at their offices. And they love it. I mean, we call it, you know, kind of house calls, you know, where I just go and I don't even charge them. That day is always a loss for me. But I always come back with a bunch of new work to do because just going to their office and sitting down with them, stuff comes up.
And that's the ultimate, isn't it, though, in keeping top of mind? If you're sitting there in their office, in their conference room, across the desk from them, you are, by definition, top of their mind.
Yeah. And, sometimes it bugs me when I do. I'm thinking, oh, how much money am I losing today, you know, driving all over God's creation to, you know, talk to these people. But it works. And, you know, I'm a solo. I do not need, you know, $10 million of business running through my practice every year, you know. And so I need to take the ones that already have believed in me. I need to invest in them and support them and just grow that nice and slow. When I left, I had 40 transactional clients. Now I'm north of 100.
Wow, that's pretty good in a year and a half.
Yeah, well, it helped because I had a separate thing, you know, Max Barkey. And when I first left the firm, I actually did a post to Max Barkey saying, hey, I've kind of turned my life upside down. And kind of the reason I wrote the post was thinking, I'm going to be putting more books out. And I want people to know that, you know, it's kind of important that if you like me,
you support me,
you know, what I didn't expect was a bunch of them would come out of the woodwork and say, hey, I need a lawyer. Can you help me out?
Yeah.
And being in California, there are a ton of software and computer related people that need me. And
the bunch entertainment of them, industry where you're located.
Yeah, but I don't really know the entertainment industry very well, but I know computers and the IT business. And so these IT and software guys come to me and I know their business and I can help them in ways that a lot of lawyers can't because they don't even know what the stuff means.
Like, you have your feet firmly planted on both sides of that divide.
Yeah. I go to the Apple Developer Conference now once a year and just get a room and I meet with clients that, you know, are in town for the developer conference that, you know, it's a very interesting practice I have. I'm not getting super rich at it, but I'm paying the bills and it's very satisfying.
And who knows? The riches may be, you know, further down the road. It sounds like the at least the curve is going in the right direction.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get to a point where I'm going to have to stop taking clients on. I mean, because I'm not...
And that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, I'm really not interested in getting space and hiring a couple lawyers. And, I just don't want anything to do with that stuff. Maybe I'll change my mind in a few years, but right now I feel firmly solo.
Well, you know, one of our guests earlier on in the program said to continue raising your rates until you achieve the level of effort that you're comfortable with. And I thought
that's great advice.
I thought it was fabulous advice, particularly for somebody who's in a transactional environment. But even if you're, say, like a family lawyer and you're doing an hourly model, if you keep raising your rates, you'll find that level, that balance, where any more... if you go too high, the number of clients drops down too low. If you go too low, you have too many clients. So you find that balance. I thought that was really pretty sound advice.
Yes, definitely.
Now, usually I ask folks about this time, what role technology plays in your success. But I know in your case, I mean, that's kind of an obvious answer because of your strong background in technology. Did you have to do anything different, or was it just kind of a seamless transition technology-wise for you?
Well, it took longer than I thought it would.
Really?
The advantage of being a solo is that you don't have to go through a committee to make changes. The disadvantage of being a solo is that you don't have to go through a committee to make changes.
Right.
So it's really easy to get lost in this stuff, especially for a nerd like me.
Right. You know,
why do I want to spend a month and a half trying out 15 different billing services, or do I just need to find the one that works and get back to billing? And I think anybody who has a penchant for technology, that's always a risk that you'll fall into, I guess what I call, for lack of a better term, productivity porn. And yeah. You start trying to get busy figuring all the workflows out and you don't actually work.
Right.
So be careful with that. And I think if you're just getting started with a solo, if you're like flung into it, you've got to do something. You know, you got to get things going. But be willing to question your decisions and your technology at all times. I mean, I am. One of the things I've discovered in the last probably 6 months is that I got one of those iPad Pros. I'm amazed at how much legal work I'm able to get done with an iPad now. And I may not be buying any more laptops, you know, and you know, as your kind of your kit changes, you see how your workflows change. So
could you envision just a couple of years ago making that same statement? I don't think I'm going to be buying any more laptops.
Yeah, I could have. I mean, really? I think the writing's
on. You saw the writing on the wall?
Yeah. I wrote a book on iPad for Wiley Press like 4 years ago. And I just knew it needed to go further. And I'm not saying that I don't use my Mac probably about 5-6 hours a day. So I've got a big iMac with a big screen. So I still use a computer. But for the mobile stuff, there's a lot of things to like about the new iPad Pros. And like for a lawyer who reads a lot of contracts, the iPad Pro plus Pencil is golden. I mean, it is really nice.
We haven't had too many people talk about the Pencil on the show. A lot of people talk about the iPad, Brett Burney and folks of his nature. Tell me a little bit about what advantages the Apple Pencil provides using the Pro.
Well, it's truly a kind of a... It's very similar to the old thing of printing out paper and using a pen to write on and annotate documents. So it gives you the advantage of kind of that analog history, but it's digital. So it gives you both the best of both worlds. You can use the analog pencil. I mean, you write on things, you can highlight, do all the things you would do normally with a pen, but it's saved digitally. And like the workflow I use right now for contracts is usually when someone sends me a contract, it's PDF. I just open it up in a PDF app on my iPad. And then I also pay $15 a month to Dragon, to Nuance. So they've got this great application called Dragon Anywhere, and it does outstanding dictation on iPad. And I know you've got built-in dictation, but the Dragon Anywhere for lawyers is totally worth the $15, in my opinion.
You've been a dictator. You've been somebody who's used dictation a lot.
That's my kids. I might be both.
So you've used dictation in your practice a lot. So it's kind of a natural... extension of that using Dragon Anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the iPad Pro, you can split the screen. So I've got the big iPad Pro. 2/3 of the screen is my document. I hold it in landscape mode. And I've got the pencil in my hand. And then 1/3 is the Dragon Anywhere running text. And it's very simple. I sit there, I'll read the contract, I'll mark up whatever I do. Maybe I'll circle something, highlight something, and then I'll push the green button on the Dragon app and I will dictate comments about that paragraph with an identification. And then I send it off to the client with the digital highlighting and the text file of all my comments. And that's the first, when a client sends me a contract, that's the first feedback they get. You know, from there, we'll have conference calls and we'll go further with it. But the original review, and I've done it differently over the years. I've done it on a computer. I've done it on paper and all these different ways. This is by far the best way. It's fast, efficient, and clients love it. So, I mean, that's one example.
Would you say that's the most significant technology advance or play in your workflow using the Pencil and the iPad Pro?
I don't know. I mean, I just think that the touch interface, there is a certain degree of delight to it that is palpable, that is more useful. Using your hands on the screen just makes more sense than a mouse and keyboard ever did. In some ways, it's slower. In some ways, it's faster. I think as if you're interested in pursuing these kinds of things, I think the trick is to get one and be willing to lose a little bit of time on some things to try them out and figure out what works for you and what doesn't. You know, follow a couple of good podcasts that talk about it, where they you can get the benefit of somebody else's time on us.
Yeah, there's a couple we'll recommend here at the end that that have a lot of value in that regard. Let's talk a little bit about marketing your firm. Now, you've talked about how successful the growth has been. Are you doing anything specifically to market it?
The a couple things. I kind of put the word out, like I said, on the nerd side, which is an advantage most solos don't have.
Right.
And that helped. I belong to, it's a thing in Southern California. I know I think they're in Boston and maybe New York now. It's a group called Provisors. And it's not cheap. I think I spent about $1,600 a year for my membership. And it's a group of trusted advisors. You know, there's accountants, lawyers of all types, you know, valuation guys. It's just a bunch of different kind of people who take on the role of trusted advisor for businesses. And we meet and we kind of give each other business. We hang out together and talk to each other. You build up relationships with these people. Now, for a small solo like me, I don't need to leverage that into a ton of referrals. But what I really, the advantage for me is I'm close friends now with a group that I call the Friends of Dave. They're, you know, there's a family law attorney, there's a patent attorney, there's a couple of really good accountants, and you know, just a whole bunch of different services that my clients could need at some point. And I've got that now to a list of about really 20 people, and I meet with them. I try to meet with one of them a month. And you know, it sounds like not a lot of investment, but it is when you think about taking the time to go get dressed, go meet somebody at some place and have lunch together. And I just try to keep in touch with all these people and be at the front of their mind. And when a client calls with a problem that fits for one of them, I send them to that person and they do the same for me. And that's been a really nice marketing effort for me.
We had Derek Coburn on the show who wrote a book called Networking Is Not Working. And he defined networking 3.0 in almost the identical terms that you've just discussed about creating a small cadre, which is an interesting word because he has a group called Cadre DC, but a small cadre of trusted resources that he could refer potential clients to. That was how he built his practice as a financial planner.
It's a huge benefit. I mean, and the other thing I do is sometimes I don't even get that much work from them, but it's still great to have them in my list. Like I have a bankruptcy guy I work with. I think I've sent him probably 5 or 6 clients over the years and he sent me one. I mean, he doesn't send me a lot of work because not many people that hire a bankruptcy attorney have need for me. But all the time, my clients have questions that have some kind of bankruptcy element to it, whether it's somebody that owes them money or maybe they're getting underwater. And I can call this guy at any time and he answers me on my cell phone. He'll answer me on the weekend and give me some good information that I can share with my client. So it's just a really good thing to have, especially if you're right out of law school. You know, find some people that know what they're doing and warm up to them a little bit.
Yeah, you know, and you also can't discount, you know, it's kind of like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game that people play. You can't also discount that while your bankruptcy guy might not be giving you work directly, he may be talking you up to other people who come to you, you know, through the side door.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of one of the emphasis that Derek had in his discussion about networking 3.0. Does social media play a role in your marketing efforts?
It plays a huge role in Max Sparky. It plays zero role in Sparks Law. I have no interest in like tweeting or Facebooking as a lawyer. And I know that for some people it makes sense. Like if you had a DUI practice or something, I think that kind of stuff makes a ton of sense.
Sure.
But not for me. And but I am going to start doing a newsletter. And I don't know if that's going to have any benefit or not, but I've been collecting names since I started the firm, and I haven't just had time to put it together yet.
Okay. Well, let's talk just a little bit about the intersection between McSparky and your law practice. Now, you indicated that you go to the Apple Developers Conference, and I know you attend and speak at, you know, a whole number of other venues. Certainly that must help get the word out about your services as an attorney at some level.
Yeah, it does. And some of them I speak kind of as to legal issues. I'm speaking at the Release Notes Conference in, I think it's in Indianapolis later this year in September. And I'm going to be talking to developers about things they should have in their contracts. So some of it's like really point on. And as a result, I do get lots of calls from people. A lot of times I can't help them because they're like in another state and, you know, whatever. For some reason, right. I can't help them. But right. I try to help them get to somebody, but do give them some common sense advice. But it also, being in California, it does turn into quite a bit of business as well.
Yeah, so I think there's a nice intersection for you. I mean, if we were talking about niching your practice and or having a supportive endeavor, it sounds like both areas of your life kind of work synergistically there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I enjoy them both. Since leaving, I have enjoyed being a lawyer more than ever. And I was never like one of those unhappy lawyers to begin with, but the practice is more fun to me now that I'm kind of in control of my own destiny.
All right. So let's take a little bit of time because, I mean, I can't spend time talking with David Sparks without talking a little bit about your other life. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, for our listeners, David is an author. He's written several, what he refers to as field guides about how to use specific products on, or tools on Apple products. Also, he is a podcaster in his own right, as I mentioned, has a very, very successful podcast called the Mac Power Users, and also a blogger. So just kind of give us a little synopsis of how that whole life got started and how you migrated to those three areas.
It was all happy accidents, to be honest with you, just following my passions. Like, I've always been a nerd, and I always enjoyed being the lawyer that showed up in court with a Mac. And everybody used to call it a toy and make fun of it. And this was now it's kind of accepted, but years ago, yeah, was not. And somebody at some point asked me to write something. So I you know, participated in a couple podcasts and I wrote a few things. And eventually I decided, well, I wanted to have my own little home on the internet. I studied political philosophy in college and I was always fascinated by the founding fathers, how each one had their own newspaper. You know, I thought that was great. Everybody had their publishing platform. And in the 80s and the 70s, that was just not the case. It was a couple big networks. It was inconceivable to me that I would someday have my own newspaper, you know. And so that kind of always stuck in the back of my mind. And I started this blog and, you know, one thing led to another. You know, so did some speaking and I wrote a couple books for a big publisher for Wiley Press. And then after that, I decided to go out on my own and I've written like 7 books now. And I also do these big video productions where I kind of show you how to do something with a video instead of a book. It just depends on what I'm
teaching. Yeah, actually, when I was writing my notes here, you know, I listed you as a podcaster, a blogger, a writer, and then I added a videographer. I'm not sure that you tout that as much as you should because I really enjoy your videos. I've spent a lot of time watching all the videos. So,
and it really depends on the subject matter. Like, for instance, when I was teaching paperless is a problem that people have. They want to get the paper out of their life. In fact, lawyers in general, really, lawyers love that book. So it's about going paperless. And there's so many different software options and so many there's a philosophy that you have to like decide upon, or how are you going to name your files? There's all these different things. So that definitely deserved a book. You know, you need a book to explain all that stuff. With a product like there's a task manager called OmniFocus that I like a lot, and I use that every day. Well, I don't need to write a book about how to use it. What you need to do is see how it works. So I made a 2.5-hour video where it's like you're looking over my shoulder and I'm teaching you all the various features of it. So I pick the medium based on what I'm going to, the information I'm going to convey.
Yeah, well, I, you know, my whole ecosystem has David Spark's paperless fingerprints all over it.
Good,
you
know, good. Is it working?
File naming conventions, and I'm looking at my ScanSnap, you know, scanner here, and all of those things.
They just added a thing that's really cool to the ScanSnap, where
I just saw you posted that in your blog. Tell everybody.
Yeah, so about that. If you've got a ScanSnap scanner, you can now, they have a cloud service. And for lawyers, this may not work. It depends. I mean, some people have security and privacy issues. But basically, you can scan documents with your scanner without having it connected to your computer. So for the one at my home, we moved the scanner down to the laundry room. So when the mail comes in, we scan it in the scanner in the laundry room and then throw it into the recycling bin, or the trash or shredder or whatever is appropriate. And the stuff just gets scanned to the cloud and then automatically sent to Dropbox. So it gets to my computer. I don't have to bring it upstairs to the office anymore, which is kind of silly, but it's really liberating at the same time.
So the scanner is connected to a cloud service, and then that cloud service can connect to whatever other cloud service that you use, and it gets dumped into a single folder in Dropbox?
Yeah, well, they categorize it. So they know, they can tell the difference between a business card, a photo, a document, an invoice. So they kind of know, they can categorize it in the cloud and send it where you want it to go. Like if you want certain things to go to one service versus another. And that's the way it works.
Well, I bet coupled with a couple of other tools, that would be very valuable in your workflow processing.
Yeah, like Hazel.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. Right. All right, well, David, let's let our listeners know, where's the best place they can become all things David Sparks? They can get access to all of your material. I know your blog and your website. Why don't you give our listeners those addresses?
Sure. If you want to learn about the nerdy stuff I do, go to macsparky.com. That's my alter ego, MacSparky. And that has the books and the videos and everything is linked right there. So you can find it all. The podcast I do with Katie is at macpowerusers.com. And the law site is sparksesq.com. And for solos, I'd recommend check out my website and let me know what you think. I wrote the entire legal website in the first person, which is unusual for a legal website. And I'm really happy with the way it came out. My lawyer friends hate it and my clients love it. But
did you design it and implement it yourself?
Yeah, it's all done myself. It's a Squarespace, you know.
Squarespace,
our sponsor of our blog, our podcast. But I'm paying for it, and they when I started making the website, I was looking at all these legal websites, and they all say the same BS about
they do, don't they?
More results oriented, blah blah blah, and you like falling asleep like by the second sentence. So I said, well, and like some of my legal friends were saying, well, you want to look big, you know? I'm like, but I'm not big. If they're looking for big, they're not going to be happy, you know? So instead, I tried to write a website to attract people that I think would like me and to repel people that would not like me. And I just decided that the first person was the way to do it. And it's kind of unique. But that's another nice thing about being a solo attorney, is you get to do stuff like that.
Well, one of the things I like about it is that it is, I mean, I this is the first time you and I have ever spoken. I feel, you know, as a longtime listener of your podcast, that I know you a little bit just from that kind of interaction. And I think your website accurately reflects who at least I think you are.
Yeah.
So, and to the extent that you want your website to reflect to your potential clients what type of lawyer and what type of practice they can anticipate were they to retain you, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the advice from Ernie Svensson as well. He says, make it so it repels people that you don't want as clients. I mean, I'm not a Rambo litigator. You want to hire somebody that's just going to, you know, lay waste to the courthouse?
Yeah.
That's not me. I don't think it works. So I'm not going to do it.
All right. Well, David, I just cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule, which is obviously a busy one, to be with us here today on The Law Entrepreneur. And I'm just going to end our conversation here with a quick question. Are you into Pokemon Go yet?
It's funny you say that. My kids are into it, and I was not pronouncing the word Pokemon right. I still say it wrong, and it was making them mad. So I decided I got to get up. I'm turning into a square here. I got to figure it out. So This morning when I took my morning walk, I captured a few Pokemon. And so now my daughter will be impressed with me. Hopefully I'll have a little bit more respect in the Sparks household.
Get a little street cred there, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thanks again ever so much for being a part of the Law Entrepreneur, David Sparks. And we'll catch you on McSparky and thereabouts.
Thank you, Neil.
Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.